Hi, this is QRadio.org's Teacher Talk program, and we enter in progress with a conversation between Nick Richert and Mark Hempel.
But he's, and he graphically demonstrates it within this piece, and if you want to see it, look it up in PerDaily.com. Is that all David Lyle is doing is building his career on a march up to possibly being a board member of education, things along those lines.
Well, wait. So the problem with what David Lyle did is he was too obsequious in his letter.
The letter suggests that we're more or less powerless, and that all we can do is plead with them to be fair.
It suggests it by taking that tone, or it actually says something that.
It takes that tone. There's nothing there which forthrightly represents the teaching community as not deserving of these rifts. Nothing there that suggests that LA Unified has the money to hold on to these people. It wasn't really necessary to rift them. It's just that they just didn't want to spend money out of their rainy day fund. Okay. They chose collecting interest in the bank on that money as opposed to maintaining all of their teaching staff. Now, Lila actually issued another letter this morning in which she refers to AB 114, the state mandate that if the district receives any further funds, they have to devote it to returning teachers to the classroom. The other side of that is those rifts that have been returned to the classroom have nothing to do with AB 114. That's just the precariousness of the district. If they choose to do so, they do it.
What's ABB 14? I'm sorry for so many questions.
It's a mandate from the state that any additional funding that the district receives has to go toward reinstating teachers, maintaining staff. What it does suggest is demanding from the district to know where that money is and how it is being spent. That's been a demand for the past 20 years. The district has always suggested that the money is in process. It's been audited before. It's been found to be lacking in being able to identify where countless millions of dollars have gone, but nothing is done about it. They've never been held accountable for it. So this audit process isn't anything which we can really expect to come to fruition where it results in more money being devoted to the classroom and their full financial disclosure being made available to everyone else. That's not going to happen. We can count on that. They've never been forced to do it in the past. Why should they do it now? Finally here, you're all aware of the compromise budget, one which says that once again, we will all bail out the country. There will be no additional taxation on the wealthy or the corporations. That was a specific demand on the part of the Republican Party in order to reach this compromise. So expect to be surrendering more money out of your pocket. The thing that we have to ask ourselves, and not just in regard nationally to this compromise, but all of us as members of the education community and the teaching community locally, is this. When are we going to stop allowing the union and the district to portray us as the minority when we are not the minority? We are the majority. We're the ones who eventually wield the power. We have to stop behaving like we're the minority. Finally here, next week we'll see the return of Neil Chertkov, and I'm sure he'll probably have a lot to say about these same subjects. So with that, I'll turn the mic over to David, if there's anything you would like to go to.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. You know, first I want to say that it's been a real honor. It's been a real pleasure for me to be co-hosting with Mark. I want to thank Nick Richert for suggesting, even giving me the idea that I could sit in for him. We're glad he's back. There's nothing like a seasoned professional at the helm. And, you know, I hope that we could kind of continue the relationship with Kill Radio. It's giving us a forum to get some really important, hard-hitting information out there. With respect to what Mark, my good friend and colleague, has said about when LAUSD and the UTLA will somehow stop being accomplices to one another, as we have said, Mark and I, and I'm sure Nick has said it in the past too, here in Los Angeles, Los Angeles Unified School District is the second largest school district in the country. Our union is the second largest union of professionals in the country as well. That's why there's an urgency in everything that, you know, either Nick would have said or what Mark has been saying, because what, again, and I've said that just about every episode I've guest hosted, is that what happens here in Los Angeles, this is the stomping ground. This is the forum where they will apply. And when I'm talking about they, I'm talking about, you know, Eli Brode. I'm talking about the current superintendent, John Deasy. These people want to apply corporate practices to a public institution, which will then improve their profit margin. But it's at the expense of compromising the quality of public education. And it's something that's worrisome, because if it happens here, again, it'll happen in your hometown, in your city, in your state, if it can be pulled off here in Los Angeles. Now, again, feel free, Nick or Mark, to interject.
Well, you know, what I might add to that as a comment to what you're just saying is this, David. It relates to it directly. A couple of weeks ago, I got in touch with Lisa Karahalios. She's a member of the board of directors for UTLA, and I requested of her that she offer a motion in the board of directors that the district dispense with Trigstad, Schwab, and Trigstad. This is the law firm that they retain that has done nothing but cut bad deals for teachers. They assume you're guilty from the beginning of either incompetence or some other inappropriate behavior, and you're basically sold out. You're told to settle for whatever you can get out of the district, and you leave. She hemmed and hawed about that and wasn't sure. She said, well, that's very controversial. I'll get back to you on it. Never got back to me at all, which came as no surprise whatsoever. But where that relates is here. When Lenny Eisenberg submitted this critique of David Lyle to LA Subs, which, again, is the primary forum to which substitute teachers respond to, this was prior to posting it in Per Daily. She immediately responded, telling Lenny that by doing so, by challenging and questioning Lyle, he was being disloyal to the membership, that he wasn't supporting the union. Now, that's ridiculous. In fact, that's virtually lapdog behavior as far as I'm concerned. It's about as obsequious as it comes. You can't question your leadership. You can't demand of them what they're sanctioned and mandated to do. There's a real problem with that. Now,
Did she say that? How did she say this? She said this like as a judgment, or
yeah, you can read it for yourself on LA Subs. It was entirely judgmental.
But it was on a listserv. What was it?
It's on a listserv.
A listserv. Okay.
Yeah, you could find it. Now, Lenny wrote a response to her, but he decided he didn't want to bother with it, so he sent it to me, and I looked at it, and it was a very thorough response addressing each one of her points. And I said, okay, would you mind if I prefaced it and I sent it into LA Subs? So I did this last night. Or early this morning, Dave Peters, who is the moderator of the forum, had to have received it because I saw him posting all the recent entries into it, all the replies. However, he didn't post this one. This no doubt relates to the fact that Dave Peters was dismissed by the district last December. Has hoped that the union would see to it that he is reinstated, which he hasn't been reinstated. Has hoped that the union would find some pseudo position for him as some sort of a pseudo rep in which he would continue to be a member of UTLA as a working member, and that hasn't come through at all either. But again, having this lapdog approach, he hasn't published the response that Lenny sent, which I prefaced, and I don't expect that he will unless he happens to hear this. And if Dave Peters does hear it, I would say stop being a coward, step up to the plate, and be fair about submitting what's said on this subject. If it's point and counterpoint, that's fine with me. But this is what you're up against, yeah. David.
Now, Mark, you mentioned a point. You say that stop being a coward. I just want to clarify. Are you talking to the superintendent of LAUSD, the president of UTLA, Warren Fletcher, or are you talking to Washington, D.C.? Because there are a lot of cowards.
There are a lot of cowards. In this case, specifically, Dave Peters, because he's the one who would oversee whether or not material reaches the pages of the forum or not. But if you want to apply that to other people, yeah, I wouldn't use that term necessarily, but I would have in mind the silent, the ever silent, the Sphinx of Los Angeles, Warren Fletcher, who seems to let David Lyle do all his talking for him. And David Lyle, to me, is, I'm sorry if you're listening and you voted for him, he's a slick-talking carnival barker.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there is that one saying that the only thing that needs to happen for wicked people to prosper is for righteous people to do nothing. So in my opinion, when you do nothing, I mean, you're complacent. You're part of the problem.
Well, you know, there's an old adage that goes, I can't remember it perfectly, but it's something to the fact that when boyhood's fire was in my blood, I dreamt of ancient free men from Greece and Rome who bravely stood 300 strong and free men. For freedom comes from God's right hand and needs a godly train, and righteous men must make our land a nation once again. That applies to us.
Yeah.
If we don't respond like that, it doesn't have to be religiously. Yeah. These people will take over.
Yeah. No, I don't mean it in a religious context. I do. I remember that quote though. As like, for a righteous, all that needs to prosper. I'm sorry. I'm paraphrasing it too because I don't remember it quite well. But the only thing that needs to happen for the wicked to prosper is for righteous men to sit and do nothing. And I think that that's what, you know, is endemic, not just in our union, but in our city here in Los Angeles and probably in our nation as well. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just thinking. So you guys are talking about David Lyle, who's the Secretary of the Union. What about, wasn't there something that you put on the list also about Daisy that I thought it was
John Deasy?
It's not Daisy? I thought it was Daisy.
John Deasy, you're thinking of.
Yeah. Didn't you put out like something happened with him?
He put out
his position on.
Well, there were several interviews that he made. The one that would relate mostly to what we're saying is this. In one interview, he talked about how deeply he regretted the rifts. In other words, taking positions away from people. And he stated at the end of it that every Sunday when he's in church, he prays for those people whose jobs he's more or less snatched from their hands. But, you know, he didn't make any mention of, I guess maybe it wasn't necessary to pray for the administrators since so few of them, if any, lost the position.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you bring that up again because I think that it would have been more productive for him to openly condemn the wars going on overseas and say, hey, look, bring our troops home. And then rehire some of the teachers. And you know, if we're going to do nation building, we can start right here in the good old U.S. of A. We could start right here in Los Angeles, which is the second largest city in the country. Well, that's going to lead into what I had plan on talking about today. But, however, I don't want to hog up the mic. So, Mark, Nick, feel free to interject at any time.
Let's get to it all because I wanted to play some part of an interview I did in New York with the Queens Alternative Superintendent of Schools.
Okay. Well,
if that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's great.
But let's hear it. I mean, definitely.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was going to say is that I think that part of the problem is, as Mark and I have been advocating for the last couple of weeks, is that part of the problem is the federal government, you know, pontificating these ideas. You know, they're on the other side of the country, and then they have to be enforced here at the local level, and we have no input and no say in those things. Let me give you an example of that. I think one of the injustices that I had spoken about last week was that I went to the Pio Pico mansion in Pico Rivera. It was the mansion of the governor, the last Mexican governor in California. And it's on a short list of state historic sites to be shut down. And here in Los Angeles, we have historic sites that are in danger and jeopardy of being shut down. And we have the L word. I don't know if you guys know what the L word is. I'm going to go back to it in a minute. But what I really want to talk about is when we're talking about the L word here, we're talking about librarians. Librarians have been riffed. It's been, I think, 2 or 3 years now, and they haven't been called back. And what do librarians do? I mean, they teach our children about Herman Melville. They teach our children about Shakespeare, how to look up, you know, assignments, how to use the internet, how to use resources, and how to teach. And rather than spend money on your taxpaying dollars, our taxpaying dollars on that, you know, if you can backtrack a little bit, Senator John McCain was saying, let the surge do its impact and changing the tide in Iraq when our troops were supposedly in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. And, you know, now we're even involved in, I believe, Libya and to a certain amount Syria. You know, it's not by coincidence that the Tomahawk cruise missiles are made in Arizona, which is the same state that Senator John McCain represents. You know, a Tomahawk cruise missile, just to make the housing, is about $600,000. Now, that doesn't include payload, ordnance, or fuel, and it being launched. Because when you tally all that in, including the shipping, the missile, launching it, and the airward innocence, it comes out to about $1.4 million. That's a Tomahawk cruise missile, and we're using those right now, like I said, in Libya. We've been using them sporadically. I think there's even some complaints that drones were launching attacks in Pakistan without the Pakistani government's permission. Meanwhile, here, how does this affect you in a local level? It's like I said, we don't have librarians. Librarians has become the L word. It's become like a scarlet letter that we don't want to fully fund librarians because we have to, you know, I believe the funds that the country has are being mismanaged. We're sending it in the wrong. We're networking the funds, which should be for urban renewal, urban development, and education, into these other questionable governmental policies.
Yeah, why is it we always have money for like there's always money for the military?
Yeah. Well, you want me to answer that for you, Nick?
If you have an answer, I
mean, let me put it this way. Let's look at this historically. For instance, you look at the battles that are the wars that turn the course of history. When you look at Western civilization, which we're all basically a byproduct of, you'd be talking about the defeat of Xerxes and Darius, the Persian emperors, when they invaded Greece. Well, the next great battle that totally determined the formation of the Roman Empire successfully would have been the Punic Wars against Carthage. The most superior general in the final stages was Hannibal. I think they're about to make a high-budget movie about his invasion of Rome. Mm-hmm. Now, he was the best general. He had the best trained army. The problem was financing it. He wasn't defeated by superior forces because he won virtually every battle that he was in. What happened to him was eventually the Romans appointed Fabius Maximus Cunctator, Fabius the Great Delayer. What he did is he refused to give Hannibal the big battle. Instead, he harassed his supply lines continually. Hannibal had to finally give up, relent, and leave the Roman territory because he could not finance the continuing campaign. And then afterwards, Scipio Africanus, of course, corners him in Carthage, and he's able to pull off the victory. This is a long story in history. You take the turning point in the Eastern Christian empires would have been the fall of Constantinople in 1453. I'm trying to think of it. The Turkish sultan that organized that, Mehmet II. He had the ability, since he was the wealthiest man on the planet, to call in forces from the entire spectrum of his empire. He even had Christian soldiers fighting for him because the Turks dominated Christian lands. There were over 100,000 soldiers in his retinue when he attacked Constantinople in 1453. That battle took a month because the Byzantines wouldn't give up. They would have actually won the battle had not someone at the turning point left the gate open. But the fact is that even if they had won that, unless the West came in to save them eventually, they would have eventually succumbed to the Turks because they couldn't financially fight it. The fact that Mehmet could organize those forces and afford to have them there, enormous expenses just feeding them, enormous expenses getting rid of hundreds of gallons of urine and feces every day. All of those little things like that are incredibly costly. He was running out of money in the adventure toward the end. Had that gate been closed, he would have been financially exhausted, had to go back, rebuild, and probably would have returned again and finished them off, you know, if without help from the West. But, you know, that's the way it is. That's what determines these battles. At the beginning, just prior to that battle, the most well-known cannon maker of his time was approached by the Byzantines. They wanted him to build armaments for him. They couldn't afford him. What did he do? He went over to the Turks, contracted with them.
Okay, so you're saying, though, that it sounds like you're saying the outcome of military adventures is based on how much money people have, but that's
where our money's going.
But that doesn't explain why there's always money for a military adventure.
You know what, Nick? I have an explanation why. I was going to say that, you know, right now, to send the American troops to Afghanistan, you know, and overseas, to sponsor them out there, it takes about the Tomahawk cruise missiles are like $1.4 million, right? To send soldiers out and put them in harm's way, it's $1.2 million. And that's the logistics, sending medical supplies, ammunition, fuel, you know, like the toiletries that Mark was talking about, right? Now, it's $1.2 million that they got to pay for each soldier over there, whether they're combat, non-combatant, support, logistic, what have you. That's
amazing.
That's not that's not including the pay that the soldier actually receives. The soldiers aren't getting paid this lucrative amount of money. The soldiers are getting paid an average $940 a month. They're being put in harm's way. They're making the ultimate sacrifice. They're sacrificing their lives. They're only getting paid $900. So where is the $1.2 million going to? Well, that's going to all the contractors that are working with the government, you know, right. Like the, you know, Carlisle, Halliburton, Cisco, ADM, all these other corporations that are supplying these things. So somebody is standing to make profit from being in a perpetual war. And those are the corporations, I think, that are ultimately the enemies of public education. Who's to blame? That's a very good question. I believe that we're to blame collectively, Nick. Mark, the general public, people listening in the show. I think that we need to stand up as a community and say, you know what, enough. What about? I'm more concerned with my son having a librarian and a full-functioning library. I'm not supporting Senator John McCain and his state, you know, by funding, you know, Tomahawk cruise missiles, what have you. That's not a concern to me. I mean, I grew up in East Los Angeles. Mark shared with us that he lives towards the South Bay. We are concerned about our community here.
So how do you make people see that? I mean, on the one hand, you have people whose interests are tied to, to selling weapons. And then, on the other hand, you have people whose interests are served by getting their children educated. You know, how do you? But the education of children doesn't put money directly into anybody's bank accounts that they can see, but it does over the long term make a society richer, not just economically. Is it maybe a problem partly of, even though we can't imagine why we should have to explain it? Of explaining to people and educating people about why public education is important?
I think what it is that the corporate media, and we had talked about that last week, you know, when you have Media One, Viacom, all these medias, the general public is just inundated with tabloid journalism, tabloid media. You know, they're more interested in who's going to win American Idol or who the Bachelorette's going to be or
the shape of the Kardashian's rear ends.
Yeah, or, oh, does the Kardashian lady wear, you know, plastic inserts in her trousers or what have you. And so what happens is that people just get inundated with this and they kind of lose sight of what's real. Last week, Nick, Mark and I had given out the telephone number, the direct telephone number to the Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton. It is in Washington, D.C. I also gave out the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. I gave out those phone numbers. And I asked our listeners here, please, you want to make a difference? You know, this is Nick Richards. This isn't Amy Goodman. We're not asking you for money. We're asking you to help make change. We're asking you, you know what, if you don't like the way the system is, that's the good thing about being in the United States is that we still have the opportunity to advocate for reform and to make change. And I gave out those numbers, those phone numbers last week, and I was thinking about giving them again, actually.
Yeah.
I'm encouraging you, please, call. Call for the sake of your children. Call for the sake of the nation.
Well, more than that, if you want to be able to drive your car over and leave it with a mechanic who can read the manual and know what to do to fix it, you want to do that. Do you want to have a building contractor who has no idea how to really read a diagram? He just makes a general guess at what it is.
Yeah.
It's not just doctors and lawyers. I mean, do you want to face a cashier that depends on coding on the buttons on a register, or do you want one that can understand how to make change? I mean, it's a serious issue.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. So please, I'm going to give out the center, the telephone number for the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. It's area code 202. The phone number is 647-4000. Again, that's area code 202-647-4000. I have an alternate phone number, which is area code as well, 202-647-5291. The Secretary of Education, Arnold Duncan, his phone number is 202-401-3000. Again, 202-401-3000. You know, I mean, it's time. I'm not asking for us, the American people, to say, okay, we've had enough. You know, let's start making, you know, blowing up buildings or any of this bonfire revolution. It's time to sit down, get a pencil, get a paper, get a pen, get a typewriter. use your word processors. It's time to start writing these people letters. It's time to start telling them that we are unhappy with the mismanagement of our nation's resources, and we are not going to tolerate it. And you know what? If these people don't start to listen to us, then they're going to be out of a job come next election. And we need to get that to them. You know, I mean, like yesterday, we've got to advocate for this. And the future of our children depend upon it. I'm not going to send my kid to war. I'm sorry. Stephen Reeves is going to grow up. He's going to go to college, hopefully. He's going to try to contribute to my society. So is, you know, my daughter, David, who you met here, I believe, 3 weeks ago. So is my baby, Tiger Lily. My children are going to go to school. They're going to try to, you know, I'm going to try to advocate that they get a good education so that they could help contribute to reinvest into the former prosperity of the United States. Now, we can't do that without your help, without you, the listener. We've got to write these letters. We've got to make these phone calls. We've got to say enough is enough. How can that help us at the local level? Well, you can also contact the president of the United Teachers Union. Tell him you're dissatisfied with his leadership. Tell him he needs to openly condemn the wars in Iraq. Tell him he needs to openly condemn John Deasy instead of calling him
his boss.
That's
how he described him, his boss.
Yeah, literally, he said, "Well, Mr. Deasy or Dr. Deasy is my boss."
And when did this? When did he do that?
About 3 weeks ago in an interview.
Yeah.
Where's the interview?
Is it the
Do you remember?
Or is it the Times?
I believe that was the one that wasn't it the one that Canianos did.
Something like that.
Which would have been the LA Times.
Okay.
No, so it's either LA Times or LA Daily News. But he went out of his way to say that Superintendent Deasy, call him Dr. Deasy, is my boss. Which Mark and I pointed out, you know, his boss are the 45,000 teachers that are paying his monthly salary, his annual salary. He's supposed to be representing us, and failure to do that then means, you know, I mean, what? He's siding with the superintendent? That's the superintendent isn't paying his salary. We, the teachers here in Los Angeles Unified School District, are. So therefore, he needs to advocate for us. If you want to complain to Warren Fletcher about this, you can email him at w.fletcher, F-L-E-T-C-H-E-R, at utla.net. And his office phone number is, I believe it's 213. I'm not sure. For 213. You know what? Try 213 area code, and if that doesn't work, then I'm sure it'll be 323. It's either one of those two. His phone number is 225-8826. Again, that's 225-8826.
Oh, by the way, if you are listening and you would like to comment on this, our call numbers are 213-252-0998. That's 213-252-0998.
Hey, you guys want to take a survey?
It's up to you. I mean, hey, you're the boss, man.
I'm not the boss.
No, but I mean,
it's your superintendent.
It's your idea.
Well, okay. Here's the survey. It's about what they're calling DZ reform. This is in response to his op-ed in the Times. So, in order to see true progress for students in LAUSD, changes to our collective bargaining agreement are needed. What do you think? Strongly agree?
Strongly disagree. I agree with him, although they may not be the changes that he wants.
Yeah. Well, I disagree because, yeah, you're right, Mark. Although we agree there needs to be changes, we're probably not the same line with the changes he's advocating for.
No, so what he means is disempowering teachers and the union.
So I'm going to write in not the changes. There's a space for you to make a comment. Daisy wants. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Number two, schools should have the right to choose their staff.
Sure. Isn't that sort of supposed to be the de facto process? I mean, if you're a teacher and you're going to go to a school, unless you're specifically assigned there, you go interview. And it's a hiring staff composed of teachers, maybe clerical personnel, and at least one administrator that decides whether or not you get hired.
Yeah, but Mark and Nick, you know, I believe that in this case, that saying, the devil's in the details.
Yeah.
You know, I think what they're doing in this is that this is a loaded gun of a question. I mean, you're going to say, yeah, on the one hand, schools do have the right to hire their own staff, right? But I think that if it's coming from the superintendent, he's meaning in the sense that schools need to hire on site, so therefore they have the right to dismiss somebody just based on
Well, he didn't say anything about dismissal.
He didn't say fire.
And I think the real thing here is who has the final word on that.
But I believe his ultimate goal in those types of things is the elect to work program,
right?
And that's what he's trying to advocate for. Ultimately, is the elect to work. And
what's the elect to work program?
Elect to work. It's like a yearly agreement between you and that school site, and that school site reserves the right to say, "Hey, things aren't working out between you and I, so we're going to let you go."
Mm-hmm.
And you also have the right to say, "Hey, I don't like this place. I'm going to leave." Mm-hmm. Right. But that goes. That's actually against the traditional contract for teachers.
Well, under those circumstances, there's no such thing as tenure.
So what do we say? The schools should have the right to choose all their staff?
Well, provided it doesn't compromise tenure.
Yeah.
So I'm going to write the same thing. I'm going to put in a comment. Provided it doesn't compromise tenure. Okay, ready for number three? There's only 10, I think. Do you guys, are you interested in this? Number three, teacher evaluations should include multiple measures, including but not limited to student achievement, multiple of observations, parent-student feedback, school and community involvement.
Yeah, how much weight do the teachers have in this evaluation? In other words, he just named off the participants, the partners in this, but he says schools, but I don't see anything where he specifically says teachers will participate in the evaluation.
Okay,
process.
So more information needed, and...
One of the things that I had been advocating for is that I really don't feel that administrative assessments of teachers is productive. I don't know why we continue that. An administrator, they can say, well, I was a teacher 25 years, and then you ask them, okay, well, when was the last time you were in a classroom? Well, they'll say 1984. I mean, that experience that they have then is no longer relevant because being the dynamic of being in a classroom, it's constantly evolving, constantly changing.
Well, they're going to argue that they come into a classroom at times and not just observe but take over the classroom. What they don't understand is, one, they're walking in with the title of an administrator, and two, there's always a honeymoon. You walk in there as a stranger, and they don't know where you're coming from, so they're going to reserve their behavior until they're more comfortable with you. Yeah. So they go in under ideal conditions.
Yeah. So and establishing a relationship in a daily basis to establish a rapport with the students, and that's what they're – they're absent in. And so, I believe that administrative assessments of teachers is false. I believe in self-assessment with a combination of peer assessment. I think that that's more honest.
Self-assessment?
Well,
I've heard that before. It's just confusing.
Well,
how is that?
Yeah, so what it means is, like, let's say, and I had mentioned this last week, I had a dear mentor. His name was Mark Mandich. Mm-hmm. He was the auto shop teacher at Jefferson High School. And so he gave me – we worked together. We team taught, in other words. It was team teaching. So I'll say, okay, well, what is it that you want to do? He'll ask me. I'll be, okay, I want to work on, X, Y, or Z. And the benchmark is that I work with him together hand in hand, and then I try to get towards that goal. And afterwards, I reflect, and he's my mentor. He's helping me. I think it was much more productive than having, somebody come in and say, okay, well, we're going to do your STUL evaluation.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, there's a huge difference. That sounds like support, not evaluation. I mean, that's...
Well, supposedly you're supposed to reflect somewhere in the STUL process. Yeah. What could I have done better? How well do I think the lesson went over? Things along those lines. But that's as close as you're going to come to it.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to put teachers needed in process, okay, and move on to the next one. Number four, tenure should require more than 2 years and include comprehensive evidence of how a teacher is doing as measured by high standards.
How much tenure does an administrator is required to have in order to reach permanency?
Do you know?
I don't know, but I know that they're evaluated at least while they're APs or principals.
Huh. Well, then more information is needed on this one.
Yeah. And I think as we talked about that, Mark, one of the things that I disagree with, it sounds to me like they're trying to put the accountability base back solely on the teacher. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's not academic success. They're not meeting the CST benchmarks. Therefore, it's the teacher's fault. I think that's really sophomoric. It's really naive to say that it's solely the teacher's fault. That's not taking into account, the socioeconomics, the politics, these other tangents.
How do you feel about grades for students then? I mean, because it's the same thing, really. I mean, how do you give a student a C when, you don't take into account everything in their lives? Or in the school, how you're failing them, how the school's failing them, how they're not well, getting
Nick,
what they need.
You bring up a good point. One of the things I wouldn't take into account is like the superintendent saying that we're not going to give homework. I mean, that's – I mean, he repealed that. I guess he realized
did
afterwards.
He, did he repeal that?
Yeah, he had it reduced to – what was it? It would only compose 10% of the overall grade.
Yeah.
That was his
idea. Yeah, yeah, I heard that part.
Yeah, so he repealed that. I mean, that's the type of top-down mismanagement that compromises the professional – the professionalism of a teacher. I mean, if they're telling us how to, it's kind of like, let's say we're here in the office and this is our war room and we're telling soldiers in Iraq how to win the war. And, you know, well, you guys aren't boots on the ground. So how do you have a firsthand professional opinion of what's going on? You don't. And I think that ultimately that's what's compromising education here in Los Angeles, is you have a lot of this top-down mismanagement. These people kind of telling us what to do and what not to do.
Absolutely. Well, so, but the thing is about tenure. I mean, I think a lot of people feel like 2 years is too short of an amount of time to give somebody tenure.
You mean you can't spot it if someone just isn't working out within 2 years?
Are they allowed? But that's what we're asking.
And in fact, I think 2 years is, in some sense, maybe more pressure, Nick, because you only have 2 years to prove yourself.
Well, I was no good in 2 years. I'm a slow learner. Yeah. If I were to be judged after 2 years, I would not.
Yeah, but the difference.
But then you get to keep going before you.
Well, the process, though, is this, though. Maybe you're not a terrific teacher during those 2 years, but are you promising?
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, I think so, but my administrator didn't.
Well. Yeah, but you know what?
He may have had other reasons to come to that conclusion, too.
Yeah, absolutely. It might be that, you know, maybe he heard one of your episodes on the show, right? I mean, and he didn't like it. We don't know. There's all kinds of tangibles in there. And, you know, the thing is, I believe that 2 years, you know, what they're looking for is they're looking for teachers that are not going to be successful. I think I had mentioned that before, that the emphasis of teaching isn't based on, you know, we're not knowledge dispensers. That's what a computer would be. It's to be a successful teacher, it's establishing a relationship with your students, and that needs to be the focus. And you can spot that on, what, within a few weeks, if a teacher is going to be able to establish a relationship with the students.
I don't know about that. I mean, okay, so but I think maybe you could tell if somebody's awesome in 2 years. If they're awesome, they're awesome. Yeah. They give them tenure. But I guess that's a different question from if you can, like, get rid of them after 2 years. It's a different question.
Right. Well, you know, the thing, though, too, is this, though. Most teachers who aren't good teachers probably aren't going to hang around much longer than 2 years because they're not enjoying it. There's a point where of descending returns, it's not worth the money.
Okay, so I'm going to put down no opinion, need more information, and say what exactly. Comprehensive evidence of how. So you don't think it should take more than 2 years for tenure? You guys are like, tenure, 2 years makes sense.
Everywhere I've been, that's what it was. I mean, and I've worked for 4 districts.
So we don't want to roll back something that we already have, basically.
I think they're trying to marginalize. Like when you're in a classroom, they're trying to undermine your opinion. You know, like. You know what you have to do, and in those 2 years, that's the testing ground. If they had a good support system, like I said, with assessments, and you have a team teaching, then you wouldn't need more than 2 years. It's like they're trying to throw the accountability back on teachers and say, well, now wait a minute, we don't know if you're competent, so now you're going to have to work for 5 years to see if you're capable of handling this. Well, I mean, you really would know by the first semester if that teacher's working out for you or not.
Okay. Raises should not be awarded simply for additional years of service, salary points, or additional degrees. Teacher raises should be granted for results and granted sooner in a teacher's career.
Name one profession where that is the case. And if that is the case, then does that also apply to administrators? And if that is the case, that it does apply to administrators, who's evaluating them? Who's determining whether or not they're making progress?
You know, I think all of these questions were brought in, I think, by the superintendent, because the superintendent...
Well, this is based on his op-ed, this question.
But his thing was that he attended the Eli Broad School of, you know, teaching former CEOs and executives how to be school administrators.
Well, this is charter talk anyway.
Yeah, that's what it ultimately is, because,
right.
I mean, in regards to your question and what you're saying... Can you repeat that question one more time, please?
Okay. Raises should not be awarded simply for additional years of service, salary points, or additional degrees.
Yeah.
Jesus, I'm working on my salary points right now.
Okay, but remember last week what the charter representative said.
Well, weren't they just cheating on that in the East Coast?
There's a big scandal right now in LA Unified where the charters are cheating.
But they were also doing it in Maryland, I think?
Yeah, Maryland and New York. Right. But last week, a spokesman for the charters, well, several spokesmen for the charters said that it's good that they have three times the number of teachers leaving the charter system because it weeds out those teachers who aren't capable.
Right.
Yeah, my thing is that when you do that saying you're going to have incentive in a classroom, all you're doing is you're putting a teacher in a very compromising situation where they have to show academic improvement through these tests or what have you. And, you know, like I said, look what's happening in Maryland, New York, and here Los Angeles. Then you end up catching these teachers, you know, cheating on the tests. So it's almost like you're pushing them into that. Compromising the education.
I guess what they're saying is that they've found out scientifically that teachers don't get any better through additional degrees or salary points. That's what they found out scientifically. And so their point is it's not efficient. It's not scientifically, it doesn't show the results. But, you know, paying people for their jobs is not just about, you know, I mean, you could dispute whether that's true to begin with, but paying people a salary is not just about how much you can get out of them. It's also about respect, you know, and it's about, you know, you've worked here a certain amount of time, you deserve to get something for that.
Well, let's look at it this way too. Let's assume you're in management, for instance, or you're a salesman, whatever the case is. You've risen toward the top in your profession. You're not selling anymore. But you're not selling any less. You're still one of the top performers in your profession. Should we say that as time goes by, that you shouldn't get raises when you're maintaining that level of performance? Mm-hmm. What they're saying is ridiculous.
I believe I had said it was a McDonaldization of public education. That's where it's ultimately headed, you know, because all of these things are conducive to, like I said, privatizing education, right? But at the expense of, you know, the integrity of the classroom.
Well, you know, in under their description, if you're the top performer in your profession and you've reached the level of excellence, if I decide I don't want you anymore because it's costing me too much to keep you around, I can just say you're excellent, but you're not excellent enough.
Yeah, and that ends up being subjective. You know, one principal might say you're not excellent enough, but another one may say, well, okay, yeah, we'll have you here. I mean, it's ridiculous how they're trying to run it. Like I said, like if it's a giant, you know, a Los Angeles Unified School District is a giant Home Depot, and we're just standing around with orange aprons.
Yeah, I was just reading about how Thomas Jefferson went back to farming after he left, after he retired, and he had slaves, and he was, you know, even though he was against slavery, you know, ideologically, it was the only way that he felt he could run a farm. And he referred to all the slaves on his farm as his machine. And he was wondering why he wasn't getting the efficiency that he anticipated out of his machine. And I heard the lady who wrote the Sally Hemings autobiography explained that it was that his foreman was the husband and the father and the relative of the people that he was working. And so he wasn't going to drive them like Thomas Jefferson expected. You know, he wasn't going to treat them like a machine. So there was not as much output, but maybe there was more humanity. You know, and I think if we're going to take out the humanity,
exactly,
then the output. You know, if you're treating people like a machine, then what kind of output are you going to get? What kind of society are you going to have?
Yeah, you know, I agree, and I think that's the ultimate. That's going to be the ultimate casualty is that, again, like I said, and you had stated, Nick, that, you know, education, the amount of units you have, the amount of studying, it's all about experience. It's all about the relationships that the teacher as a professional and the rapport that he establishes with the students. And that should be the emphasis on there. If you're good at relationships and establishing those trusting relationships and establishing ultimately trust between your students and yourself, you're going to be a good teacher. It doesn't matter where you go. It doesn't matter what city you're in. It doesn't matter the demography of the students you're serving. If you can establish that trusting relationship, and that should be what we should focus on.
Well, there's a paradox in effect here too. When we consider this, they're talking about complaining about what they're paying teachers because, by some measurement, that they're artificially want to institute. They're not earning it. On the other hand, they are among the highest paid administrators. In fact, they are the highest paid school administrators in the nation. Yeah. Why aren't they questioning that?
Okay, so we need to link, like, the administrators to what they're asking the teachers to do, and what they're that's a really important issue. Do you guys want to continue? We have four more. I think I'm going to attach that interview to the podcast, and it'll still be on the podcast, but we can go to the end of...
If you're into this, then... Yeah.
I seem to be into it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you suddenly you've been captivated by it, so...
I'm going to a new TLA barbecue after this, and I'm going to be able to respond to them, you know, in person about what I think about these questions. So. Yeah? All right. Teachers who are successful in challenging underperforming schools should earn additional compensation.
Well, you know what? I agree that I think all teachers should get compensation, not just teachers, you know, in challenging areas. All teachers in general. I mean, that's how bad, you know, and I know this has been spoken of repeatedly, but, you know, like in Japan, you know, the status of teacher is something that's very respected. It's like a doctor. It's like a lawyer. Oh, you're a teacher, and they're compensated, you know, for that. I think that all teachers should be compensated for that. And I had mentioned earlier that, you know, we have librarians in the city of Los Angeles that don't have a job. It's almost – and that's why I mentioned it's the L word, you know, because it's almost like they're the scourge of our society when, in fact, they should be, you know, celebrated. They're passing on knowledge to future generations.
But you go to a school in a neighborhood where, you know, the kids are in foster care and there's like – it's a totally different kind of, you know, learning environment. It's harder.
Yeah.
Should you encourage teachers to go there with more money?
No, I mean, I agree with that. I agree that teachers should be, you know, given more money. But I agree all teachers should be given education. The profession itself should be something that is respected in this country and compensated accordingly.
Yeah, what you're talking about, Nick, is what they used to call combat pay.
Right.
You know, being willing to go into that. But, you know, I would have another concern here. At every school you go to, now maybe you haven't been teaching long enough, maybe you both of you haven't been teaching long enough, but you know, coming out of it after 28 years, let me tell you something. At every school you go to, you'll always find a small number of teachers who are very, very familiar to the administrator. They always hold down these positions where they're the Title I coordinator or something along those lines, where they get a stipend that amounts to an extra anywhere from $2,500 to an extra $5,000 a year, maybe even more in some cases. In fact, one of the last schools I worked at, they were actually stupid enough to allow themselves to be convinced by an autocratic principal to select her lackey as a full-time Title I coordinator to pull a salary which was above every one of those teachers except a few of them that were at the end of the line like myself. That is the sort of abuse which goes on with this extra money. A good share of the time, those people that supposedly are excelling, they're excelling by the principal's definition. They are hand puppets, sock puppets.
Well, you know what? That's exactly, though, that you and I were just saying about a second ago is that, you know, one principal might say, well, you're not up to the performance, and another principal might say, well, you are. That's subjective, it's capricious, and it's arbitrary. You can't allow that. I believe that, you know what, we should reward, not combat pay. I know that they're saying like this, like a Title I school that has a high need. Well, I'll tell you what, there are schools that don't have social workers. There are schools that have social worker, but the social worker is so overwhelmed that they don't do any case management. All they do is referral,
right?
And they do a very poor follow-up. You know, so my thing is those schools that have that need, you know, they need to have the funding to bring those people in. But then again, we should all be compensated accordingly. I think, you know what I'm writing?
How about improving conditions, not simply paying teachers more? How about making it so that it's not that hard? Maybe having two teachers per class instead of...
Yeah, team teaching, you know.
Okay. Number seven, we must do away with such restrictions on pilot schools and allow successful models to proliferate across the district.
So in other words, exempt the pilot schools from all of these contractually agreed upon statements or policies.
Well, why don't we just exempt the public schools from all the contractual things and then just forget about public schools altogether?
Yeah, why not generalize
pilot
it?
Schools altogether? Let's
exempt the pilot schools, but let's exempt all of the non-pilot schools.
Exactly, and then you won't need any more pilot schools because, you know, you'll kind of even up the playing field. If you will.
Even Ramon Cortinas himself said the original intention of these pilot schools, these charters, was to develop systems of curriculum implementation which, if they showed promise, would sift down to the regular schools. that was never meant for them to take over, which they have.
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to give you an example of one of the problems with public schools, and I believe I had mentioned this before with Mark. You know, when you have students that are under the influence and they're allowed to stay in a classroom because, you know, the ADA funding that the school needs, so they need every student in class, even if they're under the influence, that, to me, is an offense to the profession of education. And that, to me, is something that I have witnessed firsthand in a lot of public schools. And maybe pilot schools don't have those same types of restrictions. Well, even up the playing field, you know, make it the same for pilot schools as you would for public schools. And I think that in doing so, you wouldn't need any more public schools because the performance of these public schools would improve.
Did you see that article that came out, I think it was last week, early last week, The Myth of the Excellent Teacher?
Times?
Maybe it was the Times. I'm not absolutely positive on that. But it was this long story that a teacher told about all the difficulties they faced. And it was I can't add to it. I mean, the difficulties were the same ones that we're all familiar with. At the end of it, they reveal that this teacher is at a charter school.
Yeah.
So, all right. So,
Oh, no. Go ahead.
I got two more questions. I don't know if you guys want. Okay. Depends which restrictions you mean. Because if they're talking about, you know, taking away the right not to be fired for just any reason, then I can't really say that that's a good thing. Number 8, the contract should guarantee that any school whose staff votes to have an elect-to-work agreement would be allowed to. Well, we don't get to vote on other things. We just get to vote on whether to have an elect-to-work agreement.
That's what I mean. This seems like why are they giving us the freedom to decide this?
Yeah, why not the freedom to elect to get rid of our administrator, for example?
Yeah, exactly. Without having to have parents demonstrate for 6 months in front of the school.
It's a lot of this stuff is just basically designed to appeal to people who think that the union is obstructing education, so...
You know, well, Nick, I think that the union is partly obstructing education, but I think they're doing it
through complicity.
Being complacent with the Los Angeles Unified School District. So both the union, I think, is guilty, but I think they're guilty for allowing the school district to spearhead this movement.
Number 9, performance should be considered before seniority in determining layoffs, including evaluations, contributions to school and community, special training, degrees earned, and demonstrated success. Seniority should be a tiebreaker, not a deal breaker. Okay, I don't even have to ask you guys what you think about this.
It's ridiculous. I mean, right. There are what is that degree? I can't remember what they call it. That all these people at the local districts are doing. It's supposed to be the equivalent of a PhD. It's not really a PhD. It's a sorry ass excuse for one in which they personally buy their way through, and it's only to get another rung up on the ladder so they can call themselves doctor my ass. Yeah. I mean, really, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, my argument would be like, how does one define what success is? I mean, you know.
How many good instructors did you have in college? I had a bunch of jackasses. I could count the number of instructors that I had that were decent on one hand. And, in fact, when I go back to that, I think of all the things that they said that proved to be patently wrong. Not just in terms of technique or theory, but they proved to be patently wrong historically. Their predictions as to the way things were going to go and all that. It was just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I'm writing I have to say... I should say disagree, I guess, or no opinion. I don't trust the administrators to evaluate performance, is what I'm writing. So if you're saying performance, yeah, if it was legitimate, like they really are better.
Oh, okay, but like, let's say we go along with that. Then here's what we do at the end of the year. We gather collectively as a unit, the teachers, and we do our evaluation of the administrator. If we find that he's lacking, he's out. Gone. Goodbye.
Well, but like Nick said, I agree, but how do you quantify – what success is. I mean, you know what I mean? You can't leave it in the hands of an administrator.
And that's exactly what they're going to argue if we try to apply it to them. So let's both argue that, then we neutralize it. Yeah.
Okay, last one. And then I want to go because I got a new Taylor barbecue. All right. Teachers at each school should be allowed to employ their own curricula and teaching methods as well as make all their own personnel decisions. That's strange. Do you think he advocated that? Teachers should be allowed to employ all their own curricula and teaching methods?
Well, here's the question that he would have to address. everything that the district offers right now, in as far as curricula is concerned, and each individual curriculum, those are all package programs, under the table deals where they agree to buy these package programs, and somebody gets paid off on it.
Read 180.
So they're going to go against it?
Yeah.
They're going to go against their own policy?
Yeah. It's strange. I mean, maybe they threw this one in. This is like this is not a Daisy proposal.
Well, then they better contact Harcourt Brace and McGraw-Hill and the rest of them and tell them, hey, you guys are... Well,
what do you think, though? Do you think teachers should be allowed to decide their own curriculum?
I have no problem with that at
all. Yeah, I think that's great. It would be... we need that, but I don't know. I mean, there's...
Well, yeah, if then you can sort of say, well, they chose their own curricula and the kids did great by whatever... You know, measures we yeah. test them, then yeah. keep
it.
Going.
Yeah, I mean, they gather in a committee and decide what they want to go with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to add?
You know, yeah, okay. If I could just one more time just give out those numbers and really urge our listeners to please consider calling them. You know, it's in our hands collectively. I mean, you know, we can make the change. We can advocate for the change that we need to improve conditions, not just in our classrooms, but across our country. Please, Hillary Clinton's phone number again was area code 202-647-4000. Arnold Duncan, Secretary of Education, his phone number was area code 202-401-3000. If you want to call the superintendent of Los Angeles Unified School District, his phone number is area code 213-241-8442. Again, Superintendent John Deasy is area code 213-241-8442, and I'm urging you, please, you know, tell them you heard it here with Nick on Kill Radio. Tell them, you know, tell these people that you want the reform. Mention, you know, the fact, any of the things that we've talked about here, because I think that's all relevant. I think it's all directly impacting public education. And again, what happens here in Los Angeles will happen in your town tomorrow. So please make that call.
All right, guys. Anything you want to say, Mark?
No, all I can say is for all our listeners, even if you're downloading this afterward, hope it was a pleasant Sunday for you.
And I want to play the Ellen Kirschbaum interview after this, so if you don't hear it, then we didn't do it. But if you hear it, here it is. And see you next week.